Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, welcome back to another episode. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacky Benjamins. We have a show here where we do two things. First, we interview somebody with a really interesting story to tell. And then in the second half of the show, we have our roundtable team of financial professionals, financial gurus, financial pundits, all get together and talk about the topic at hand. Today, we're talking about one financial independent person's journey, and we're excited to do that here in just a second. But first, have you ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all of that online chatter on social media? Your wait's over because the Buzz Index is an index that uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, and you can make their edge your edge. How do you find out more? Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. And on today's show, we're going to talk about one person chasing financial independence journey. I'm so happy he's here to join us today. Mr. FI Guy joins us. Taylor, how are you, man?
Good. It's good to be here.
I'm so happy you are going to tell us about your journey. So people, you know, a lot of people listening hear about this thing, financial independence, retire early movement, right? I know that you sometimes go to some of the meetups that people have around the country. What was it that attracted you to being financial independent at an early age?
Yeah, I would say there were two events that really kicked me off on the process. The first was marry my wife, actually, because my wife is a very frugal person. She brought those frugal habits into our relationship. And before then, I mean, I would save money. I was never in the hole every single month. But as she brought those habits into our relationship, we saved more every month. I started liking having more money. I started liking to put that money to work. And then I'd say the second one was right about that same time when we'd gotten married. And this was approaching 5 years ago now. I read The Richest Man in Babylon. And I think that sometimes you stumble upon something that it's the exact right moment for you to read or hear that advice. And that was me with The Richest Man in Babylon. So at the same time, I was reading thoughts from The Richest Man in Babylon. My wife is bringing these frugal habits to our relationship. And so I don't think I had coined the FIRE, financial independence. I hadn't coined any of those terms, but I knew that I liked saving money. I knew that I liked growing money. And as time has gone on and I've been working in more traditional roles and I see that I don't think everything's as rosy as people paint it out to be, I just want to give myself as many options, as many opportunities as possible. So maybe that doesn't mean I retire at 35 like some of the FIRE all-stars you hear out there, but I figure worst case scenario, I'm more prepared than the average person out there. So that's kind of what turned me onto the path.
It's funny because you talk about your wife being frugal and people see people like you that are financial bloggers and they think that these are people that are naturally frugal. Were you frugal growing up? Were your parents frugal? You come from a family where you talked about money a lot?
No, actually, we were not frugal at all. I mean, we were to the point, we grew up in a very small town. So even to the point of when we needed to do school shopping, we would drive a few hours to the closest big city. And my mom would just have us go to whatever mall she knew we could all get the shopping done. Whereas my wife is coming from a situation of her mom would go by Ross for a month straight and look for the perfect pants. But my mom knew she didn't have that luxury. And so she would just try and buy as many things in one spot as possible, which, I mean, often meant that she wasn't getting necessarily the best price. And so I grew up not really worried about getting the best price on things. Or if I wanted something, I would just buy it. But my dad was also, he made pretty good money growing up. And so we were never worried about money. So I think that was also a factor. But at the same time, he didn't really talk about money. But over the course of time, he's started talking about it more. I wish that he would have talked about it more earlier with me, though.
Do you ever think, though, that to your mom's point, that like time is money? You know, you got these, how many kids were there?
There were seven of us.
Right. So you got seven kids. I'd be like, damn it, we're getting in here. We're getting out of here. Time is money. If I spend less, especially if I got to drive a long way, you know, that time equals money. But I suppose it sounds like that was never presented to you. Like, that's why we're doing this. This is our own version of frugal. We're being frugal with our time by getting stuff done quicker.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah, they're in a very different situation having seven kids. I mean, my mom always had activities going on. I think that my wife, the way that she views things is like on a Saturday, for example, we can go shopping at three different grocery stores. And is it obnoxious? Yes. And I've actually been bailing out on a lot of those excursions lately. I say, if you want to go to three stores, you can go on your own. But the way that she pitches it is like, what would we be doing otherwise? And if that is sitting on the couch watching a sports game, hard to present the value of the time that I would have gotten out of that, because again, I would have been sitting on the couch. So that's where I also identify with what she's saying. I think a lot of times people want to use excuses to continue with behavior that maybe not be the best.
Right.
Instead, I think it's important to look at your own individual situation. So for us being two pretty newly married people, I mean, 5 years with no kids, we don't have nearly the constraints when we're at home. So we have the flexibility to maybe do some of these slightly more inefficient things to save some money, which for our situation has actually resulted in a lot of money over the past 5 years. So it's definitely been worth it.
I should ask how old you are too.
I'm 29 and she's 26.
Let me ask about her growing up then, because her frugal habits came from somewhere. I mean, her parents must then have also been frugal.
Yeah, I think it comes from her mom. Her mom is a sucker for a good deal and not buying things she doesn't need because it's a good deal, but anything she wants it to be the best deal possible. She's going to search forever. She's going to tack on, I mean, not as much coupons, but she will tack those on. So I think it definitely comes from her. So I think that my wife kind of gets a rush out of getting a good deal on something that we actually need. But luckily that doesn't impede into a zone of buying things that we don't actually need, because I think that can also be an issue with those people that have that
extreme, that same type the of extreme couponer mentality when your whole house is full of toilet paper that you won't use for 26 years.
Right? Exactly. So I have like the perfect balance of my wife really loves to be frugal, but she doesn't like to buy anything unnecessary. So it's just basically the things that we buy, she just wants to make sure that we're thoughtful about it. But over the course of our marriage, I mean, we started out making about $50,000 a year, probably $45,000 a year between the two of us. And at that point, I mean, in order to save a good portion of your income, you need to be very frugal.
Sure, right.
But over the course of the 5 years, I mean, we've dramatically increased our income. And so I think that that's let her rest at ease a little bit, because we are still very frugal and we haven't let lifestyle inflation kind of creep in. But now we can afford to buy a few extra things, and it still doesn't really sacrifice our overall savings rate or our trajectory to financial independence too much.
You wrote on your blog, on your about page, which is MrFiGuy.com, on that page you wrote that you guys started off saving 40% of your income. That was your starting point, was 40%.
Yeah, kind of crazy. And so when people say like, I can't save any more than, I don't know, 5%, that was kind of our baseline back again when we were making $45,000 a year. And since then, we've been able to increase it to about 70. I haven't fully calculated in making extra payments to our mortgage. So it's probably 72, 73, 74%. But really just making it a conscious effort, again, not going out of our way to buy extra things and making sure that we actually value the things we purchase.
Well, let's dive into some of those, Taylor, because, you know, you said your wife has some very frugal habits. You saw her frugal habits that kind of attracted you, attracts you to her. And then you became attracted to being frugal also. What are some of those habits? You talked about three grocery stores. That's slightly frugal. What are some other frugal habits that your wife has that you've picked up?
Yeah. And that's the funny thing is I don't feel like we actually have that many crazy frugal habits. We just try and get the big things right once. And so we don't try and make a million good decisions. For example, when we signed up for our cell phones, we just tried to get a great job when we signed up for our cell phones. So the two of us pay $80 a month. I actually get my cell phone actual payment paid because I happened to buy on Black Friday. So good deal on our cell phones. We got our internet for $25 a month. We both drive paid for cars. My car is actually really old, 2002. And we live in an affordable house. So we just try and get the big things right. And then it's not a decision every single day about how I can save money. But at the same time, we do actually use mint.com quite a bit to look at our transactions that come in. So we're not to the point of budgeting. We're kind of over that point. but we do like to look at our transactions coming in. So then we know, like, do we have any weaknesses? Are we maybe overspending any in any particular area? But for the most part, we just live our lives, and we've gotten to the point that we've kind of programmed ourselves like the type of spending behavior we don't want to have. And now it's actually pretty easy.
It sounds like you guys have a lot of money conversations. Do you have like a set money meeting where you look at Mint together, or is it just kind of the two of you because you're a couple money nerds? It's what you do for fun.
Yeah, I would say we're definitely, or I'm a money nerd. My wife is definitely not a money nerd. Right. So whenever I try and talk to her about money, I mean, specifically things like investing, like I always tell her, like, what if I die? You have no idea what our money is doing. And she's just like, oh, I'll figure it out. So she's just very much on the frugal train.
That's still is scary, though. It still is a scary statement.
Yeah, no, it is. And so my goal is to at least introduce her to it. Most of the stuff would be pretty easy to grasp, luckily. But still, it's very much me leading the charge in terms of the actual investing. And I would say looking at Mint, that's very ad hoc. Each of us will log in kind of on our own multiple times throughout the week. And so I'll get messages throughout the day at work. Hey, what was X transaction? And I'll just tell her like, oh, yeah, that was this. And then she'll be like, oh, OK. So then she knows how to categorize that properly. But I wouldn't say that we have any direct finance conversations, like a meeting, but we do talk about money pretty freely.
Yeah. And I think very important there is you both use the same controls. You're both logging into the same portal to see the same data all the time. I think, I mean, whether exactly. It's Mint or Clarity Money or whatever you use, personal capital, whatever, that's huge. You talk about your cell phones and paying $80 a month. I like this idea of getting the transaction right up front so that you don't have to worry about it. I mean, why think about your money all the time when you can just nail the big stuff? Tell me about like cell phone package and how you made a decision to buy the particular cell phone plan that you got. What went through your mind?
Yeah, I think just getting, again, the absolute lowest price for what we would get out of the package. And that's what we're always looking for. Like, what is the bare bones things that'll meet our needs? So for example, with the cell phone, we actually negotiated with the guy pretty hard. We had kind of an indirect relationship with him. He was a friend of a friend. I feel like this characterizes our relationship with money really well, is that when we met with him, he said, you know what, I'm going to write you this or add you to this special plan, but there's the possibility you won't get it every month. And so you may have to just text me every month if we don't get it, and I'll make sure that you get this discount. And sounds a little bizarre, because most people would maybe think, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to have to worry about saving that.
I don't want to text Bob every third month to get my savings.
Luckily, we've only had to do it about 3 times for the past 2.5 years, but we have had to do it. And I think most people would immediately be turned off by that, and I'm not going to do that. But that saved us $40 a month for the past probably 3 years. So little things like that, we deal with in our internet provider. They're notorious for not having great customer success. I've told a few people, because we were living in an apartment, we bought a house, we had to transfer the service over. And I was telling some people about kind of the hoops I was having to jump through to get the service transferred over. And a lot of people are just like, I just would have thrown in the towel. I just would have canceled that one, gotten the more expensive one with better customer service. But then I think to myself, now that I did it, it was maybe a little frustrating for a week. But now that I've done it, that saves me $25 a month, not being with that more expensive provider at least. So just between those two decisions, getting those right, I'm saving $50 a month, which, again, those two things, you can very easily discount $50 a month. But if you pile that on maybe 10 other decisions that we've made, it starts to become real money.
Sure. Yeah, it's not about that one. The Richest Man in Babylon, you mentioned, is a book that changed your life. What was it that was the turn on about that book, especially for people that haven't read it?
Mainly, it's just a very easy book to read. I read it in just a few days. I'm not a great reader. I didn't grow up reading tons of books. So it just really clicked with me. I think he uses very simple analogies, which was kind of shocking to me because my brother actually recommended the book a few years earlier. I thought it was a joke when he did it. And I was like, I'm not reading this book. I ended up picking it up because I remember him telling me that. We started going to library again, my wife's frugal habits. Saw it there on the shelf, decided to give it a go. And I think the thing that resonated with me most was when he talks about getting gold, that gold working for you, creating more gold, and it will have children, and those children will continue to work for you. It sounded obviously like a very intriguing idea that I make money once and then that money works for me. And there will come a point that my money actually outworks how hard I can work.
That was my favorite part of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, by the way, was your money being somebody going off to work every day like you are with a lunch pail and you're going off to work and your money's going off to work. And I thought, man, if my money could go off to work and I could sit on my ass at home, that would be, you know, and I say that and I'm not really a lazy person, but it's still, that's attractive that, hey, if I'm not having a great day, my money's still out there working for me. So I love that. And you're right, Rich Dad, well, both Rich Dad, Poor Dad and I meant to say Richest Man in Babylon. Those aren't thick books, Taylor. Those are pretty skinny books.
Yeah, and I give the credit to Richest Man in Babylon, but during that same time, I searched for most well-known personal finance books. So I read The Millionaire Next Door, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, The Cashflow Quadrants of Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Right.
So I read all of those books. Again, I credit The Richest Man in Babylon because I feel like it started me on the path, but it was all of those books that kind of fueled me in those beginning stages.
Yeah, like Tony Robbins says, you hear this truth repeated over and over, there's something to it. If one person says something, it might be kind of winging, but if you hear the same thing from people that know what they're talking about, it probably is a truth that I should follow.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree with that.
Let's talk about your investing habits. I love the fact that, you know, people think that a lot of these bloggers out here started off as frugal. That wasn't you. Number two is that they're making a ton of money at the, you know, at the beginning when you're trying to do it at $50,000 and you're saving 40%. That's pretty amazing. And it's by nailing the big stuff. These are all things other people can do, which I think are pretty exciting. But investing, is your investing pattern then esoteric?
Yeah, I don't jive entirely. I'm not like a Mr. Money Mustache guy where I have maybe 100% VTSAX, as everyone will say. I do have some individual stocks in my portfolio. And while I am toning those down a little bit, I actually think that there is room to pick individual stocks. And I think that if that's something that you're interested in, I think there's lots of cool tools that someone with the time propensity can take a look at individual stocks. But I do try and eke out a little bit more from my returns. So I do try and add like a component of small cap value, some emerging markets, total international, as well as just the total stock market fund. So that's the primary base are those four areas.
But it's interesting, just as an aside, I mean, you look at those areas in particular, small cap value is an area that has beaten the S&P 500. Emerging markets is the hope of the future that will beat in the future. That's always been my favorite place to invest money. I just think it's a fun place to invest money too, or in some of these emerging economies and things going on there. And then when you look at the world becoming more global, I mean, having money in that spot too, once again, hasn't paid off historically. That particular one hasn't paid off. But you look at the past versus the future, that's a place where I could definitely see some changes.
You always talk about this as well, the efficient frontier and things like adding more investments with seemingly more risk. When you add those together, actually looks to smooth out the path. So with me having a smaller bond allocation, adding these things that don't correlate exactly, it can help to smooth out my path because being 29, I had basically no money during the last recession. So I can't say firsthand how I'll react. But I know that I've been so involved with this community, I would hope that I would be more prepared than the average person. But again, I'm looking for anything I can to smooth out that so I'm not seeing just the massive gains. Because yeah, I could go small cap value because according to the research, small cap value has outperformed everything. But who knows what might happen during any recession because small cap values, yeah, if that hits me 30, 40, 50, 60%, then that might cause me to jump ship, and that's right. The worst thing that could happen.
Right. Like my partner on the Stacky Benjamin show says, the strategy always works until it doesn't, right? Charting your path. What do you use to chart your path to financial independence? When do you see that happening? And what do you plan to do after that? Because that's a big part of financial independence people don't talk about is, okay, you're going to retire, Mr. Smart Guy, at 32 years old. I'm not talking to you, Taylor. I'm just saying some people I read, you're going to retire at 32. What the hell are you going to do then? And people haven't spent any time doing that. And I don't have any medical proof, but you see these people that just die young And I think it's because they lost their purpose. They're so busy worried about getting out of this job they hate that they're not thinking about after that. So tell me about plotting and when and after that.
Yeah, I would say in order to plot the path, I use Personal Capital a lot for that right now. I love how you can run your exact investments through a Monte Carlo simulation. So I use them all the time, adjust my assumptions moving forward. But really, a lot of that depends on my wife when we decide to have kids and what she decides to do after we have kids. So we're leaving that up in the air. I don't think it'll be one of those 32-year-old bloggers, but I am shooting for financial independence, at least at a lower level, by late 30s. So we just hit a net worth of $500,000 a few months ago. And so that's super excited about that and looking to keep that train going. But to your bigger point, I think that is a big issue, is everyone just wants to escape. And I've seen, hard proof that basically when people retire, they're much more likely to die. People in Japan live a long time because they don't really have the same concept of retirement. And so I'm not really trying to retire and not do anything, much like you mentioned earlier. I don't know exactly what that thing is right now. I'm enjoying this blog. Who knows? It could be this blog. I also think that I don't need to be 100% financially independent in order to quote unquote retire from my job. I think the more that I've been exploring this, there's hundreds of thousands of ways to make money. And I'm confident that if I went in, we'll say 2 to 3 years from now, when I was 31, 32, and if I decided to travel for a year with no prospect of coming back to a job, I'm confident that I could find a way to make money that would actually pay the bills. I think that people are too caught up with, especially early retirees, having such a 100% degree of certainty that they won't surpass the 4% rule. And so maybe they're even using like a 3% rule, a safe withdrawal rate. But I just think most people, if you're to the point that you're driven, you've gotten to where you are, I think you're going to have a hard time not making money. And yeah, even without trying, you're going to find a way to make money. So that's kind of my viewpoint. I'm not too worried about what that hobby will be, because I know I've gotten here by working hard, by being driven and motivated. So I think something's going to present itself in the future as well.
I think the exciting thing from where I sit, Taylor, is you're buying yourself flexibility. You know, kids come, you can be flexible. You can keep the savings rate going. You can back it down a little bit. You'll have the flexibility to do whatever the heck you want later, which I think a lot of people, you know, they don't think about that. They think about there's Acorn, you know, I don't know what it is, if it's like the three little pigs analogy or the squirrel with the acorns, but it seems like you're picking up a bunch of acorns now so that when winter comes, as I mix another third metaphor in there with Game of Thrones, that when winter comes, you're ready.
Yeah, this is the conversation I have with my wife all the time. If we were to never save another dime, using the rule of 72, I just do kind of rough math to double that out. And I tell her we could have well over $3 million by traditional retirement age by not saving another dime. And I think that's the value. That's the time value of money. That's
what does she think about that?
To work for you.
Well, absolutely. Sorry, but I'm worried about the interpersonal stuff. When you say that to her, what does she think?
She thinks it's pretty cool. It doesn't make her want to let her foot off the gas because she wants to get to the point of financial independence. But obviously, it's pretty cool. And she's starting to now grasp how well we're doing. Because for the first 2 to 3 years of our marriage, I wanted her to loosen up just a little bit. And I would say like, oh, well, we're saving XYZ and my coworkers are only saving this much. And she would always say, well, why are you comparing yourself to these people who aren't doing much? Like,
nice
you need to
job.
Go compare yourself wow. to the rock stars out there. And she's starting to kind of accept, because again, we've hit like a pretty good net worth at a pretty young age. And she's starting to realize, actually, we are kind of leading the charge on a lot of these fronts. And so while it hasn't really impacted us letting off the gas, she's realizing that we're actually doing something pretty special.
Do you think that she'll ever not be frugal, though? Like, do you see yourself doing things that are not frugal, or is that in hers and in now your blood?
I wouldn't say it's in my blood. I would love to drive a Range Rover. So give me enough money, I'll get a Range Rover tomorrow.
But you're going to buy one used and you're going to get the best deal for it.
Most likely.
Yeah.
Yeah. But her, no, I don't ever see it changing, or at least in material ways. So for example, she drives a Honda Civic right now. She loves her Honda Civic. And when I ask her, if you could buy any car you want, if money wasn't an issue, what would you buy? And she says, I don't know. I really like my Honda Civic. So I think that just expensive taste doesn't run through her. Like, she doesn't kind of get a kick out of having something super expensive. So I think you're right. I think at a certain point, it's going to be difficult to say, hey, we don't have X number of dollars coming in every month, and we now have to live off of it. Granted, we're financially independent based on all these projections. We should never run out of money, but it's going to be a tough shift to go from we're not adding every month, we're going in the hole every month. And I guess we'll have to cross that bridge when we get there, because that'll even be hard for me based on like the amount of money we're saving each month. And I love seeing my net worth grow up. There will be a point where the net worth isn't going up anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to track. I love tracking you on your blog. Tell everybody, by the way, about your blog. You find Taylor at MrFiGuy.com.
Yeah, so over at Mr. Fi Guy, I'm just blogging about my path to financial independence. I try not to give any one specific approach that anyone needs to follow. And I also understand that everyone has their own lives with their own priorities. So I just really try and point out the importance of spending money on things that you value most, on things that are going to bring you the most happiness, and not follow or blindly spend what society is expecting of you.
I like the diary aspect, though, about what things you're confronted with, the decisions you make, the way you talk about Richest Man in Babylon, as an example. In fact, a recent blog post that you have is about lessons you learned from ancient texts, which is fun to read that stuff. We'll link to it in our show notes at moneytreepodcast.com. Taylor, thanks for hanging out with us and telling your story. That's something people don't get to hear enough of. So thanks a ton.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
And before we invite our crack panel in to talk about today's interview, if you've ever wondered if there were a way for you to take advantage of all those people on social media talking about investments, your wait's over, because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds. They're now at your fingertips, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund and trading under ticker symbol BUZ, provides investors with a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment when they talk online. They don't use surveys, which we've seen can be skewed and can be wrong. People tell you what they think you want to hear. There's no guessing. Instead, the Buzz is a fly on the wall, and they target the most mentioned large cap U.S. stocks across the social media landscape, just as people mention them without asking them. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the Buzz. Each of the most mentioned stocks is given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics, and the 75 stocks that have the most bullish score, those get included in the index. Every month, then, the Buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights. And again, every month, 75 more companies with the most bullish score, those are selected, and that positions Buzz to capture the highest return potential. So invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for more. Just a quick disclaimer, I use the Buzz Index in my portfolio. Doesn't make it right for you. It's been great for me, but do your own homework and check it out yourself. moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. All right. So let's talk about Taylor. Let's talk about frugality. Let's talk about financial independence, retire early. All good things there. We're going to start by saying a how you doing to my friend in the desert, Linda P. Jones.
Hey, Joe. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Now that we're here, how can we never talk? And joining us, Miranda, I know you're as excited as I am that we have a friend up in Idaho where they grow the best potato. That's Miranda Marquette.
Yay. Way to go, Idaho.
Do you grow the best potato, Miranda?
I personally do not grow potatoes, but I do like to eat potatoes. So
I ran a race in a marathon in Idaho. And when you finished, they gave you a sack of potatoes. And I had to give mine back because I couldn't take them on the plane.
Why not? What's wrong with taking potatoes on the plane?
I didn't want to check my luggage. So
you're lazy.
So I'm lazy. And a guy who's not lazy, to get off that point, it's Mr. Doug Goldstein.
Hold on. I'm going to go get a falafel. You know, that's the food that we eat here. And plenty of potatoes, too.
Falafel sounds wonderful right now. I'm starving. Let's not talk about food. I do want to talk about that crazy grocery store story that Taylor talked about. But first, let's talk about frugality. Let's dive in. Linda, do you think frugality is the key to being wealthy?
I actually don't. I think that's a common idea out there that, you know, spend less than you make and someday you're going to be wealthy. But if someone makes $50,000 a year, let's say, and they save $20,000 a year, it's going to take them a very long time to get to $1 million. So I think the misconception, not that it's not a good habit to have, not that it's, you know, not a righteous thing to do. I'm just saying, I don't think it's what is actually going to create the wealth for people. What is going to create the wealth for people is to invest that money and to get it compounding and growing for you. And that's where, if you can get returns of 8-10% or more per year, you're going to be a millionaire during your lifetime. So it's all about the compounding in my book.
But it seems like, Doug, you see these people that get lots of money and they don't hang on to it. I think frugality then is the difference between people who become wealthy and stay wealthy, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I would just not use the term frugal. I agree with Linda that I don't think you have to spend your life being frugal, but I do think you have to not be irresponsible. I have literally watched people throw away millions of dollars that they got as an inheritance when they were younger, and they could have invested it and been not just millionaires, but 10 million, you know, 10 times that or 100 times that had they just been responsible. And they didn't have to be frugal. They were allowed to spend. They just had to spend way, way too much money. So if you're going to try and find the balance of who you are, the best way to do it really is just to keep track of your spending. Because the moment you keep track of what you're doing, all of a sudden, everything becomes real. You say, okay, this is how much I spend. And I think just doing that for most people is enough. Doesn't mean you have to start living on a tight budget and watching every penny. It just allows you to live a normal, responsible life. If you need to be frugal, okay, so go ahead and do it. But I don't think it's for everyone.
And you know, I just want to say, I'd like to define frugality, because I'm all for being a smart spender. It's that people who think that they can't live life, they can't enjoy life because they have to sort of be a miser. If that's the idea of frugality, that's not what I'm for. That's not what I think is going to get people to eventual wealth. But I think being smart about your spending, I'm all for that. And, you know, more millionaires shop at Costco than anything else. So millionaires are definitely thinking about smart spending, saving money, things like that. I'm just saying, I don't want to put money at such importance that you decide that you can't do anything because you can't spend money. And you have to hoard it. That's what I'm talking about with frugality that I don't agree with. So I just want to be really clear about that. I'm all about smart spending, saving money, buying on sale, buying wholesale, all that stuff. Yes, absolutely. But it's not about not spending and not living life.
Miranda, let's get you into the conversation. To Linda's point, is it then about defining, I guess, what gives you happiness and only spending money in those areas?
Yeah, I agree with Linda. And I've talked about this a lot, where for me, it's more about like priorities and what you want your money to accomplish for you. And so just saying I'm never going to have any fun in my life and I'm going to hoard it all until I can retire at age 35. And then what are you going to do? Like, so yeah, so like Linda, you know, for me, it's more about smart spending. It's about looking at your priorities. And it's about saying, okay, what makes sense in this situation? It's not about going into debt. It's not about being prolific in your spending. It's about taking a step back and saying, all right, what matters to me? What do I want my money to do for me? What do I want to accomplish with this? And so, you know, when I'm putting together my spending plan, right, it's mostly automatic. And I'm like, well, I want to make sure I've got the retirement covered. There's contributions to my son's college fund covered, housing, food, insurance, like that stuff is all covered. And once I've got enough and I'm working toward my goals, I don't see the point in hoarding money to the point where I've got a big pile of money that I may never spend. You know, I mean,
yeah,
right. I want to enjoy myself. I like my life. I like my life now. I am putting money in retirement accounts, you know, against the future, just in case something happens and I can't always do exactly what I'm doing. But the reality is it's just being frugal for frugal sake, or being frugal to build up a big pile of money so that someday you can retire and do whatever, like, doesn't make sense to me. And if that's what you want to do, that's cool. I don't care. You can do that. That's fine. That's your life. And that's what makes you happy. What makes me happy is, you know, feeling like, you know, I can be comfortable in my life. I can do stuff that I find purposeful in my community and have time to do that while at the same time still, you know, reaching my other financial goals. So to me, it's more about balance and about creating a lifestyle you enjoy with due, you know, with due consideration for the future, rather than just saying I have to cut all of my expenses to the bone as much as possible.
And I completely agree with Miranda. And I've talked about the five spending priorities in the past. And, you know, a lot of people want to travel, for example. And I love to travel. A lot of us all travel and love it. So you can do that in a smart way. You know, you can get credit cards that, like, I have one for my air travel and one for my hotel travel. And I use those cards for business and, you know, rack up the points on those so that I have free travel during the year. You know, that's something that can save thousands of dollars, but it's not, you know, I'm not having to live in a way that's restricting me from being able to actually enjoy my life. And so those are the ways to be smart with money.
That's a very pragmatic way of looking at it. I think one of the things we should just address is that there's also the psychological element that as it pertains to someone actually spending money. You know, we often use the term retail therapy. You're feeling down about something, whatever bad thing happens. So, you know, you go shopping because it makes you feel better. You get that quick up. And I think that you've got to realize that people do that because just like they may smoke or drink or do something that's, or drink in excess or to each his own, but, you know, something that people shouldn't be doing. And I think we've got to realize that if you're the type of person who is using money as a tool to make yourself feel better, that's something really to worry about. It doesn't matter how much you're spending.
It's funny. Taylor talks about a quirky habit that his wife has about going to three different grocery stores. And we all know people that have done some pretty quirky, frugal stuff. But I also know you guys well enough to know that you probably have one habit that people might think is a little quirky when it comes to your own frugality, even though you don't call yourself frugalistas, we'll put it that way. Doug, is there something where people in your family kind of roll their eyes and go, oh, that's Doug's frugal thing?
Well, many years ago, I read Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek, and I was completely taken with the idea of outsourcing. And I began outsourcing all sorts of projects to people all around the world. You know, I had people in the Philippines and South Africa and Europe and South America, everywhere. And every time someone would say, oh, Doug, could you do this? And I'd be like, yeah, I can do that. And then they could see I was thinking, how am I going to outsource that to pay someone, you know, a fair amount of money in his or her country, but for me, which is a really, really good deal. So I know that it almost became something that, you know, my family would tease me about. But frankly, over the years, I've employed dozens of people and had great relationships with people all over the world. So I stand by my by this idea of finding people who can do the work better than I can at a lower price than I can. And I thank Tim Ferriss for that idea.
Did you see the headline? It's been a couple of years now that we did a story about it on Stacking Benjamins about the guy that completely outsourced his job to somebody in China. Like his entire job, he was able to teach somebody in China how to do it, and he just kept the margin. And he sat at his desk all day doing nothing.
Wow.
While somebody else did his work. Yeah.
I'd love to hear that episode. That is amazing.
Let's turn to Miranda. I bet, Miranda, you have a quirky, frugal thing that you do.
Oh gosh, no, you are asking the wrong person.
You've got one.
I've been trying to think about this while Doug was talking and really trying to think this through. And I think the closest I have to a quirky, frugal thing is when I road trip, I like to take a cooler of stuff and put it in there and bring a cooler of things and bring food for us to make ourselves. And because a lot of people think that's kind of weird because you have enough that you could, you know, you have enough money or you make enough money that you could like buy most of your meals while you're road tripping or do something like that. But part of this is a health issue as well as like a money issue, right? Because like you're making your own food, you've got healthier food. So that's kind of what I do is I load up this cooler. And it makes my son roll his eyes when I'm like loading up this big 5-day cooler with food. But yeah, so I mean, I think that's the closest thing I have to a frugal quirk. I mean, like Doug, I outsource a lot of my stuff. I pay somebody to clean my house. I pay somebody to mow my lawn. I do grocery delivery services. I mean,
yeah, that's not really because I'm penny pinching,
right?
Miser.
Exactly. And that's the point is I don't do a lot of the penny pinching miser stuff. Because I find my time more valuable. I'm more frugal with my time and more stingy with like where I put my time than I am with what I do with my money. I use my money to buy myself more time.
I'm very frugal about my car. I've been get kind of razzed by friends about my car because I drive a Trailblazer with well over 200,000 miles on it, and it's definitely a beater, and the muffler rattles, and I'm not getting rid of it. I mean, it gets me from point A to point B. Engine works good enough to get me there. So that's kind of my car's kind of my frugal thing. So fun stuff. Linda, how about yours? Let's talk frugality and Linda P. Jones.
Well, one thing that I think is so easy for people to do that will save them thousands of dollars, and we don't talk about it enough, is just paying an extra 1/12 on your mortgage. So let's say your mortgage is $1,200 a month. You divide that by 12, that's $100. So you pay an extra $100 or $1,300 a month, and that will be one extra payment per year that you're making. That goes right to your principal. It's something that will help you pay down your mortgage faster, save you years of paying extra payments and interest, and it will literally save thousands of dollars in interest. So paying an extra, usually it's $100 or $200 a month. If you can't afford that, just pay whatever extra you can, even if it's $50 or $25 extra a month. Just do it because it adds up over time and it will literally save you thousands of dollars. It's one of the biggest cost savings benefits that you can do that's really easy that, you know, we just don't widely promote enough.
I love that idea, and I'll even take that a step further, Linda. If somebody is comfortable with the risk of the S&P 500 and you've got a 30-year mortgage, I like not putting that extra money directly into the house. Take that extra money and make a separate pay off my mortgage early fund with the S&P 500. You'll find that interest rate over long periods of time historically has been so much higher that you pay it off even quicker. What do you think about that?
I like that too. I mean, with the interest rates so low, unfortunately or fortunately, the benefit that people are getting isn't that great because you're only paying off a 3 or a 4% interest rate right now. So I think, yes, if you could invest that and get 8 to 10% in the long run, you would be much better off. The problem is a lot of people have more difficulty making that extra step. I mean, remember years ago, it was always buy term and invest the difference, and nobody invested the difference.
Right.
And so I know that that's an issue for people to actually get that extra step done, taking the savings and putting it into the investment account. So if that doesn't happen and you can just make your mortgage payment an extra $100 per month that's automatically taken out of your account, I think that's still a winning idea that's going to save you thousands of dollars.
Yeah, great stuff. Let's just move to the FIRE movement. For people that don't know that term, it's Financial Independence Retire Early movement. Really exciting stuff there. A lot of people joining this trend of trying to get their financial house in order, not only just in order, but really aggressively in order. But I worry that some people aren't thinking or might not be thinking about financial independence in the right way. And Taylor and I talked about that just a little bit. But Linda, I guess sticking with you, what do you think people should be really focused on if they're hoping to be financially independent at an early age?
Well, I just want to say first that I understand that there is a dramatic desire to want to have financial freedom and to get out of this chain of slavery, the rat race, whatever you want to call it, especially if you're not enjoying your job. But I think the real issue is not enjoying the job. And if you can match your skill set, match, you know, what you're meant to do, a job can be a tremendous growth opportunity. It can be something that's really positive. It can be something that makes you a better human being and really stretches you. And I'm all for work. I personally love to work. I think a lot of people who do retire and take time off really get bored. They lose their social system. My father was an example of that. A lot of Boeing employees die within 3 years of retirement because they lose their friends. They're bored. They don't have anything to do. They sit around the house, get depressed, and watch TV all day. And that's what I'm concerned about is going to happen as people think that getting away from the bondage of, you know, working for someone. But I also think that that's not the real issue. The real issue is not being happy in matching your skill set with what you're really meant to do and your purpose and not feeling like you're fulfilling your life's purpose. And so I think getting aligned with your goals and your skill set is important so that maybe you can love what you do and not feel like you've got to get out of that system so badly. Does that make sense?
I love that idea. It's not about what you're going from. It's pay attention to what you're moving to.
Exactly.
I really like that. Miranda, last question for you. What do you think, if you're interested in the financial independent retire early movement, that you really should be focusing on more that you don't see people focusing on enough?
Well, I just think a lot like Linda says. I mean, a lot of the time they're focused on, oh, well, I got to escape the rat race. I got to get done with this, you know, whatever. And people are always asking me, and we've said this, I said this before, people are always asking me, hey, when do you think you're going to retire? Like, are you planning on retiring early? And I'm sitting here going, I love my life. Why would I retire from my life? Like, why would I do that? That makes no sense to me. So I think a lot of people miss the boat in terms of, you know, they're so focused on, oh, I got to amass all this stuff, quit my job, and then retire early, rather than thinking, what kind of life do I want to build for myself? And how does the way I use my money, how does the way I invest my money, how does the way I spend my money, think about my money, all of that stuff, how does that help me create this life that I would find fulfilling? So I think that's what a lot of people are missing. They're just so focused on the end, which is, oh, I'm just going to retire, that they don't really think about, okay, well, what then? And what am I doing to create a life I want?
Which is why I like this idea that Taylor's more focused on, which is buying himself flexibility, right? I don't know what the future is going to hold. I'm not interested in retirement. I think I like to work. And this is kind of, Miranda, what I hear you saying. You're just buying yourself flexibility.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everything from how I work for a fully remote company to how I have this podcast to how I have my own websites, all of that stuff kind of, and then the freelancing, all that stuff builds so that I can create my own schedule to a certain degree and have the flexibility to live where my son is benefited by growing up here, where I have the flexibility to travel, where I have the flexibility to be involved in my community. So yeah, it really is about buying flexibility.
Doug, for you, anything to add about people that are aggressively searching for financial independence? Maybe something they should be thinking about more?
Yeah, I just want to go for this word flexibility. I'm just wondering, is that like a euphemism for not motivated to give back to the world? You know, if the point of working, right? We always say that work isn't a job if you love what you're doing. And people who are givers will always find a way to give. And there's plenty of people who need a little help. So if you, like what Linda's saying, if you're not happy in what you're doing, maybe it's because you're not actually giving enough to others, which I really think is the core of happiness. So I'm just not impressed, you know, and I'm a little scared, actually. Only recently I began hearing more about the FIRE movement. And wow, that's kind of frightening that there's a lot of young people whose goal in life is not to help the world, but rather to just, you know, be lazy or do nothing or have flexibility.
I don't think so. I think it's the ability though to help out in a way that you want to help out instead of the way that you think that you're tied to, right? If you're tied to having to help out in a certain way just to make a paycheck versus the way that you're passionate about. I mean, look at Miranda doing what she loves and clearly helping.
Yeah, but she's not retiring early. She's not a FIRE person here. This is financial independence and early retiring. You know, FIRE and retire early. That's not Miranda.
Yeah, I think there's two halves to that equation. I mean, I don't think that's Taylor either. Taylor's buying himself flexibility because he wants to have a child in the future and they want to go from two incomes to one and not have to worry about, you know, where's the extra money going to come from by saving more aggressively today. That makes him more independent today and able to take care of his kid in the way that he wants to. I don't think that's being lazy at all.
So why is this different? Is this different from just being wealthy and making sure you're taking care of your money? What is it about the FIRE movement per se that's different from what you and I did? We worked, we built a business and we had enough money. We raised kids and I don't know, my wife took a lot of years off too.
I agree with you there. I think it's just a sexy title for what people have always wanted. It's somebody finally came up with a sexy title. I totally agree with that.
I think they are wanting to get out of the chains, you know, have the financial freedom. And I totally understand that desire. It's very strong. It's a good thing. The one concern I have about the FIRE movement isn't that they're not going to give back, because I think they are. And I think that they just want the flexibility to really live life and enjoy life and not be tied to a desk for the rest of their life or tied to a job or a corporation, but to try and get ahead and really enjoy life. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. What I'm concerned about is if someone is able to retire at 35, and they live to be 100, how on earth are they going to know that they have enough money set aside to last them the rest of their life? Yeah. I think it's unrealistic to think that they will. And I think at some point they're going to need to either be an entrepreneur or come back into the job force. And I hope it isn't, you know, trying to get back in 10, 15, 20 years later when they don't have the skill set anymore to try to get back in and make more money. So I hope they've thought that through. I hope that they have a way to continue to make money and not just try to live off of their investments because they're spending that money and it's not going to be there for them later in life.
Yeah, that's what bothers me too, is that I think that we haven't paid enough attention to inflation, and 40 years is enough time. Miranda, I know, Miranda, you've got to go. So let's talk to you first. What's coming up at adulting.tv, at Planting Money Seeds, and everywhere else where you are?
Yeah, just a lot of stuff. We're actually thinking of relaunching adulting.tv and doing a rebrand. So be looking for that. So that's kind of crazy. And we've got a little projects. I've got projects at Planting Money Seeds, MirandaMarquette.com. And then, of course, you can always find me at Student Loan Hero. It's just a mishmash of crazy right now as we move into the summer. So just go everywhere and see everything.
Great. Go everywhere, see everything. That's great advice. Well, Linda, how about you're everywhere?
Well, I love to get the pulse of what people are talking about. And I did a podcast about real estate where people were really stressing over whether to sell or not sell. Where are they going to be living in the future? Is there going to be a crash in real estate? All this conversation that's going on right now. So on Be Wealthy and Smart, I talk about the 5 steps to making real estate decisions without regrets. So they can find that on iTunes, or if they're on Android, they can go to lyndapjones.com.
Awesome. And Mr. Goldstein, how about you?
I've gotten a lot of response to a show I did a few weeks ago on the Goldstein on Gelt show called The Dangers of PFIX, Passive Foreign Investment Companies. These are offshore mutual funds. And a lot of times Americans who live overseas, they go into their local broker or bank and they just buy a mutual fund because that's what everyone kind of does. And it turns out this is a terrible, terrible idea for Americans to do. They should not be buying these things. And we spoke about that on the show, and I guess a lot of people around the world found this quite compelling and, in fact, had to change what they were doing just because of this one episode of the Goldstein on Gelt show at goldsteinongelt.com. And that leads me, Joe, to ask you, what is going on down in the basement at Stacking Benjamins?
That's awesome. Well, at our other show, Money in the Morning, we talk about headlines every day. We take 2 headlines that are in the financial press, and then we try to put these 2 headlines that seem to be very different. We try to put them together with a big idea every day, and that's at Money in the Morning, Monday through Friday. So guys, that's going to do it for today. Thanks to Taylor for hanging out with us. His site is MrFiGuy.com. And Miranda, take it from here.
Make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. And don't forget to check out MoneyTreePodcast.com for archives and more information and resources from our panelists. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at MoneyTreePodcast.com for more free investing resources.
Bam, that just happened.